My name is Elise Gerhart. My family lives here in South Central Pennsylvania, and we are part of the resistance to the Sunoco Logistics Mariner East 2 pipeline and the fossil fuel industry in general. So this property where Camp White Pine is, my family moved here in 1982. I was born in 1987. And I've lived here ever since. The plan, as far as my family was concerned, was to manage the majority of the property as a conservation area, to engage in forest stewardship, which we have done since the 80s. And so this place has become a pretty diverse and vibrant piece of forest land. Probably been at least 80 years since it had been clear cut, given the size of the white pines that are left. It's pretty important wildlife habitat. There's all kinds of critters here. I'm not a wildlife expert, but to name a few, we've got vernal pools in the wetlands that are critical habitat for amphibians. We've got a pond that supports other types of aquatic wildlife. There's migratory birds that come through and use that area. We've got pileated woodpeckers, black bears, just a general, like, Pennsylvania wildlife, I would say. Seen some flying squirrels recently up in the tree sits. It's pretty cool to have them as visitors. Turkeys, flocks of turkeys pass through here from time to time. So, yeah, I mean, up until this whole thing with Sunoco happened, it was, had the feeling of kind of a sanctuary in a way. It was never going to be developed, you know, not on my mother's watch, not on my watch. Well, we do have the homestead up the hill here, but you know, we try to minimize the impact of that. Not too into the idea of lawns or things like that. We have a small patch where we grow our own food. But, you know, other than that, this place was left kind of to its own devices, left to continue rewilding itself. So, Sunoco kind of came in and disrupted those plans a bit, you know, with wanting to turn a space like that into an industrial zone. So we've got streams here. We've got two streams on the property that are part of the Juniata watershed, which is part of the Susquehanna watershed. We're kind of in the western reaches of the Susquehanna River watershed. The springs for those streams are actually on this property. And so to us, that seems pretty important, you know, to care for those streams and maintain them. I mean, not that we're doing anything to maintain them, but, you know, trying to prevent them from being destroyed, I guess, seems pretty important.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, like, you know, part of this is, you know, human-centric. It's about rights. It's about safety. It's about, you know, having the right to defend yourself from harm and having the right to live a peaceful life. But another part of it is environmental, very much so. I mean, growing up on a property like this, it's not particularly surprising that I became an environmentalist. But, you know, that was my plan, was to continue stewarding this land and protecting it. And so I'm really just trying to follow through with that obligation at this point. We have a handful of large white pine trees that are still standing in the easement due to a defense that was done last year to protect them. And those trees have now been fortified into a pretty elaborate tree village, if you will, with platforms and traverses and, you know, capacity to support a small village of forest defenders.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a few banners that we've put up, specific to the pipeline resistance, but we've also used this installation as an opportunity to express solidarity with other campaigns and, you know, raise awareness about other issues, such as, you know, the recent release of two political prisoners, Oscar and Chelsea, and solidarity with Palestinian hunger strikers. So, yeah, we've got a lot going on here. It's, you know, become kind of a vibrant little spot of intense resistance, but also, you know, there's a lot of positivity here, and there's a lot of love, and there's a lot of community. So we not only built the tree village, but we're building that community too. So Sunoco Logistics approached my family more than 2 years ago, seeking an easement for the Mariner East 2 pipeline. In the first discussion about it, they threatened to use eminent domain to take the land if we wouldn't give it to them for the amount of money that they decided it was worth. And since then, we had been fighting it in court. We were sued for the property through a condemnation, also known as the eminent domain process. We went through county court doing that, and the local judge, George Zanuck, he ruled against us and in favor of the company, even though the project didn't really meet the criteria for use of eminent domain. It's not serving a public good. It's not serving us or neighbors, anyone in Pennsylvania, or really anyone domestically except for the corporations involved. It's all for export and use in the plastics industry. So, yeah, that fight didn't, you know, go well. It kind of went as expected, though. The state of Pennsylvania is extremely corrupt and in favor of industry, not just for pipelines, but the fracking industry as a whole has a history of being in favor of industries like coal and things like that, and generally against the regular working class people. So, we fought permits for about 2 years as well. There were a lot of people that were fighting permits, across the state, organizations, individuals, grassroots community groups, nonprofits, litigating against both the use of eminent domain and the permitting for the project. Because even based on existing laws, even though the legal system in this country is far from perfect and far from being able to uphold people's rights, human rights, and rights of the environment, even within that framework, this project is illegal and shouldn't be allowed to use eminent domain. It doesn't meet environmental regulation standards. Yet, those regulatory agencies like the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection have just allowed it to happen. They're, and not just allowing it to happen, they're facilitating it, they're permitting it, they're talking about how great it is, and actually sitting down at the table with these industries, excluding regular people from those talks, and figuring out how they're going to not only build the Mariner East 2 pipeline, but they're figuring out how they're going to build 30,000 miles of pipeline in Pennsylvania over the next 10 years. And this 2017 is actually the first year of the implementation of that plan. That's collaboration between the state of Pennsylvania and many different entities within the fossil fuel industry and plastics industry. Based on all those things, we tried to contact regulatory agencies from the county level up to the federal level. I had phone conversations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, with the DEP, with the County Conservation District, went to all the meetings we could, did petitions, letter writing, phone calls, litigation, all of that, and yet here we are. And Sunoco is building the Mariner East 2 pipeline right now. And so last year, in March of 2016, it was a few months after Judge Zanuck ruled against us in the eminent domain case in county court, Sunoco decided they were going to come down and do clear cutting for the project. And back then, they did not have a single permit for the project. They had no permission to build the pipeline, even as far as the state was concerned, but they just independently decided that they were going to start clear cutting.
They
So
already had eminent domain for your property at that point.
they had eminent domain on this property, but they had no permits for the project.
Okay.
And so it was really, really preemptive. But they came to do it anyway. And the reason that I believe they came to do it was as an intimidation tactic. They didn't have all the easements secured for the pipeline at that point, and they wanted to scare people into signing easements. And so we decided that we weren't just going to stand by and let them do that. We organized a series of tree sits along the easement on this property, my family's property. It's a 3-acre easement, at some points 150 feet wide. It's a pretty big area, and so we had three tree sits along that area. I occupied one of them, and the company came in. They brought a lot of police. And they arrested the property owner, my mother, even though she wasn't standing on the easement, she was standing on her own private property that isn't even being disputed. They arrested two other supporters, one of whom, who was put on $200,000 bail, another person was put on $100,000 bail. For really doing nothing more than like advocating for the safety of the people in the trees, telling Sunoco that what they were doing was wrong. I mean, no one who was arrested did anything but have conversations with the police and the workers, and yet they were hauled off to jail and put on these ridiculous bails.
Like, they weren't, like, physically obstructing their movements or anything?
No, none of the people arrested during that clear-cutting were physically obstructing anything.
What were they charged with?
They were charged with disorderly conduct and contempt of court. Two separate counts of disorderly conduct. One is a misdemeanor, one is a summary offense. And then another summary offense of contempt of court, which people were warned or threatened by the judge before this all happened that that would mean an automatic 6 months in jail. No conviction, no trial, no jury, no nothing, straight to jail for 6 months. That didn't happen, thankfully. But people were subjected to an 8-month-long court process, only to have those charges then dropped. I was not arrested during that tree clearing. I was occupying one of the trees. They didn't try to extract me. They never told me to come down. I was charged about a month later and, you know, went through the court process with the other people who had been arrested. And yeah, we were, in the end, you know, let off the hook because, from what the district attorney said, after a rigorous investigation during that time, they determined that we were on private property and those charges did not apply, which they obviously knew from the beginning, from before they even decided to come here, because this whole thing is regarding issues of property rights. It was never unclear to them that this was private property.
What, I guess I'm just curious, do you know exactly what different kinds of, like, police or sheriffs came in? And can you sort of describe, like, you said they didn't tell you to come out of the tree, but, mm-hmm. like, what do you remember about, like, things the workers of the police were saying? Or, like, their demeanor and sort of, like, the interaction when they were here, like, their attitudes?
So on the first 2 days that they came to clear cut, they showed up, you know, right off the bat with more than a dozen police. I was told there was about 16 police those days, and that was the sheriff's department, the Huntington County Sheriff's.
Okay.
And their demeanor was pretty callous and smug, and like they didn't really understand the situation that we were in, and they didn't really care. Mm-hmm. When they were doing this clear cutting, when Sunoco was doing this clear cutting, you can see, you know, how close to the trees that are still standing, you know, that they were cutting. All of those trees are down around them, and some of them were being felled into the trees that people were sitting in, into lines that were, you know, life support lines, like, for safety. And we were trying to explain that to the workers and the police, and they seemed to take it as a joke.
So they were like felling trees while people were in the tree sets. Did anyone like tell them that that was dangerous, or like did they like have things to say at the time?
We were telling the police that what Sunoco was doing was very dangerous. Mm-hmm. That, you know, felling into lines that are actually like holding up someone's life when they're 50 feet up in a tree, felling trees into large branches above a platform that somebody's sitting in, those are very dangerous things to be doing. And we were telling them that, and they did nothing. They said, oh, they know what, the police said, oh, they know what they're doing. They're professionals. You know, don't worry about it. They claimed that they were here looking out for people's safety, but when real safety concerns were coming up, they weren't doing anything about it. And what they indeed did do was, you know, so they're doing that. There's one very large tree up there on the hill above the place where I was sitting. They were getting ready to cut it, and I'm screaming at them like, hey, are you out of your minds? Like, that's uphill from this tree. you know, and I'm just sitting up there, and I couldn't even come down had I wanted to. Mm-hmm. There was no way for me to do that safely with all those trees being felled all over the place. So I'm pretty much trapped up there, right? And they're getting ready to fell this giant tree above me, and I'm yelling at them, and they're not listening. So that's when our one friend walked very calmly partway up the hill to try and tell them, like, hey, that's really dangerous. Don't do that. You could kill somebody right now. And she was arrested and put on $100,000 bail. And when I was yelling down to the police, I wasn't yelling at the police. I was yelling to them saying, why won't you help us? You know, why are you letting them do this? Their response was to smile at me smugly and wave. And so that was, you know, incredibly frustrating. You know, not only just given like what was happening, but like where this is, like, this is my home. I, you know, have lived here since my parents brought me home from the hospital, you know, and you're gonna just let these thugs come in and put my life in danger on that property and then claim that you're, you know, protecting and serving the public? That just doesn't add up. You're letting them put my life in danger and my friends' lives in danger. People who have our permission to be here. Yet you're here enforcing these people who we're very adamantly telling, no, you're trespassing. You can't be here. You have no right to do this. And, you know, so that's kind of the way it went.
Was there any kind of, like, did the police or Sunoco, like, notify you that they were going to come do cutting, like, cut trees on your property on that day?
They did that day. Mm-hmm.
They called ahead before they showed up?
We knew in court there was a short court proceeding before that happened, and so we were aware of the date they were going to come that time. But then, so they clear cut for 2 days then.
Yeah.
They cleared almost all of this, everything except the trees that were occupied or tied into trees that were occupied. And then everybody left. The police left, the workers left, majority of the supporters left. And then a week later, we're just sitting up at the house. It was like me and my family and one friend. And we hear chainsaws. I was actually on the phone doing an interview. And we just hear chainsaws, and we come running down here, and we find them right here trying to cut down these trees. Like, that one tree in the middle there has a notch in it at the bottom. You can go up there and see it from where they were cutting into it. And I had to run up and say, no, what are you doing? And they were trying to explain to us what they were doing here, that, you know, they had a right to be here, and don't we want to listen to them? And I just kept telling them, no, like, you have no right to be here. Because according to their own injunction, which they used to come in the week before, they said they had to be done by March 31st because they didn't want to, you know, violate the Migratory Bird Act and blah, blah, blah. And they care so much about hibernating bats and whatever. So we told them, like, you guys said by your own accord that you're going to be done March 31st and that we were going to cause you irreparable harm if you didn't get it done by March 31st, and then you just show up. They just showed up. And these are big trees, right? Mm-hmm. That is a dangerous thing to come onto somebody's property and do with zero warning. Zero warning we had when they came back on April the 7th.
Oh, so that was after the whatever endangered species,
yes,
that deadline that they were expressing concern about. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that deadline is March 31st to not, you know, violate the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, or I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's, you know, this thing put in place to protect migratory birds, nesting birds, bats coming out of hibernation, things like that. So, you know, we were telling them no. They were trying to explain to us how this isn't bat habitat. They determined that it wasn't bat habitat, even though there is a protocol for determining if, like, certain trees or forests are bat habitat, and they didn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to do with, like, observing at certain points in the day, and, you know, they didn't do any of that. They didn't know if there was any, you know, endangered species in this area. They never bothered to do any kind of study like that. Like, that's another big misconception with these pipelines, is that, like, the companies are forced to, like, really do environmental studies. They're not. They never came out here on the ground with any kind of, you know, wildlife experts or anyone like that to, you know, document what type of wildlife lives here. They just get on a database that is incomplete because no one's ever come out here to do that study. They just do, you know, guesstimations, basically, and, you know, never identified plant life here. Just, they just come in and start destroying stuff, and it's not even on record what's being destroyed. So they did that. That was after the people who had been arrested the week before got out of jail. So when they came back, that unexpected time, they arrested my mother again. They arrested my friend. I was able to get back up that tree before the police arrived. So they again didn't arrest me that time. My mom was held in solitary confinement for 3 days on a supposed suicide watch, even though she's not suicidal, never expressed any suicidal ideations or anything like that. She's, you know, she's fighting for life here, not, you know, she doesn't have a death wish. So, but they just wanted to restrict her ability to speak to a lawyer, to speak to anyone else. She had contact with her elderly husband cut off. You know, she's his primary caregiver and was just unexpectedly taken away for 3 days from him and couldn't even, you know, call anybody else to come and care for him because she had no way to call anybody on this restricted suicide watch.
Did they hold her without bond for 3 days?
No, they put her on 5,000 bail that time, which it took us the 3 days to get that together. You know, we don't just have $5,000 laying around for bail. But we were able to, with the help of an organization who's been really supportive, get that together. We didn't actually pay the bail. The organization paid the bail. But yeah, until we were able to pay the bail, she was, you know, stuck in there. And then the friend was also bailed out by a family member for also another $5,000. So that happened. And that was all before they had permits for this project. Mm-hmm. All of that, you know, 5 people criminally charged, people being put in isolation, people's lives being put in danger, this just complete harassment, arresting landowners on their own property without any guarantee that the project was even going to move forward. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it happened. The second time they came, I guess I'll note that was the state police that time because it was kind of on the fly. Uh-huh. The first time was more organized. The sheriffs had been authorized by Judge Zanuck to come out and escort the pipeline company and arrest anybody who got in the way. And then the second time, I don't think that Sunoco told anyone they were coming here, informed anybody, because it came as a surprise to the police, I think, too, that mm-hmm. time. The state police actually got pulled off of a drug bust to come here and arrest my mother and a friend, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, where are the priorities there? You're going to come and arrest a retired special education teacher who's being harassed and abused by this multi-billion dollar corporation instead of dealing with, you know, the serious
drug problems that we have in this state. Not that I'm advocating for the state to deal with those, but it's just like they say that that's their priority. You know, they say that like dealing with the heroin problem is like a major priority because we have a lot of young people dying in the state of Pennsylvania, in West Virginia, from heroin and other opiates. And the state claims that like dealing with that is a priority, and yet when they say they're out there busting these drug dealers or whatever, they'll just stop what they're doing and come, you know, arrest retired teachers instead.
So I guess, I think the last question I had about, like, police interactions up until this point is, like, there's been, like, either the local sheriffs or the state police, have they called ahead or, like, tried to have any conversations with you at all? Or has that been, like, few and far between? Like, is it fair to say that they're not really communicating with you very much, but they seem to be actively coordinating with Sunoco? Like, would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I would say that the sheriffs and the state police are coordinating with the company, and they've made zero effort to reach out to us. They've made zero effort to defend our rights against a company harassing us, abusing us, violating environmental laws, violating property rights. They seem completely disinterested in doing any of that. And not even just, like, turning a blind eye, like I said. I mean, we had the situation where my life was imminently in danger from a giant tree being dropped on me, and my friend went to quietly and calmly tell them that that was not okay, and she wound up in jail with a $100,000 bail because the police arrested her.
And so it seems like the, like, sort of legal or, like, the basis for the police or the sheriffs or the local courts, like, essentially enforcing Sunoco's will onto your property, it's based on the classification of the pipeline as a public utility?
I would say that's what the courts would say. What Judge Zanuck would say is that Sunoco is an established public utility, which I disagree with. What's happening with the Mariner East 2 pipeline is that back in 1932, this pipeline, which is now called Mariner 1, was built. I don't know what it was called back then. I believe it was owned by a different company at that time. And the purpose of that pipeline was to transport oil from refineries in the Philadelphia area out to areas like this and Western Pennsylvania. And they had easements for that pipeline, which is a half mile north of here, not on our property at all. What Sunoco is doing is saying, well, we were granted public utility status for that pipeline, for the Mariner East 1. So that means that in all circumstances, whatever we do, whatever product we're shipping, wherever it's going, we are a public utility. But in reality, there is a huge difference between an oil pipeline that is actually bringing a product from a refinery to people in Pennsylvania for their use, and a pipeline that starts in Ohio and ends at an export facility in southeastern PA and is going overseas to be used for plastics manufacturing. and the courts are refusing to acknowledge that difference. They're refusing to make Sunoco get certified as a public utility on a case-by-case basis, on a project-by-project basis. Mm-hmm. They're just allowing them to use these antiquated easements to build this entirely new project that has an entirely different purpose.
So did they... Like, so Pennsylvania's Public Utilities Commission, or Public Utilities Board?
Yeah, Pennsylvania Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, so did they specifically classify Mariner East 2 as a public utility, or
no.
was it just like a carte blanche because Sunoco is a public utility corporation and they're building it?
Yeah.
So they already had that classification under law before they came onto your property in 2016, or not, I guess is what I'm trying to clear up.
Sunoco applied to the Public Utilities Commission for a certificate of public convenience for the Mariner East 2 pipeline, and then they withdrew that application. It was never decided on one way or the other by the PUC. And so then instead of applying for a new certificate for this new project, they then just turned around and said, well, we'll just use our existing certificates. And the PUC never found an issue with that. The DEP never found an issue with that. The courts don't care. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're doing. They're saying, once a public utility, always a public utility, which makes no logical sense. Like, if you have a company that bakes cupcakes and then you suddenly retrofit your kitchen to become a pizza place, that doesn't mean that you're still a cupcake factory, you know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't make sense. So that's the truth as I understand it, and the twisting of, you know, the process as it's happening in Pennsylvania. And beyond that, and the Mariner East 2 pipeline is an interstate pipeline. Like, even Sunoco admits that it starts in Ohio. You look at their maps, you know, on their website. It was really generic sort of map of it starting in Scio, Ohio, and ending at Marcus Hook in near Philadelphia. And yet the federal government, the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has been hands-off of this project. And that doesn't make any sense to me either. Not that the FERC is a beneficial agency to be regulated by, as far as the people are concerned and the earth is concerned, but it just doesn't make sense to me why this project is not federally regulated. How in the heck they're just going state by state for an interstate pipeline, and how they're going county by county to get eminent domain. The reason they're doing that is because it is easier to buy off local politicians, local judges, than it is to, you know, buy off the whole, you know, federal government, I suppose. But, you know, again, that doesn't make sense with the nature of the project and the laws that are on the books. Like, there's nobody enforcing the laws of Pennsylvania and the United States right now when it comes to pipelines. So that puts the people and the land in a really precarious place, because there's no one looking out for us. You know, no one but ourselves and our communities. And, you know, this sort of spread out resistance to pipelines. There's no one else that's doing it. The Pennsylvania DEP can impose fines, and indeed has imposed fines on Sunoco Logistics in the past, in the recent past.
They find them for a 2008 spill into Turtle Creek, where there was a bunch of gasoline that was spewing out of a pipeline directly into the creek. They find them for doing work on Mariner East 1 without any permits. When Sunoco was retrofitting the Mariner East 1 to start carrying NGLs and to start carrying the product in the opposite direction, they just went ahead and did the work in five counties, including this county, without any permits.
Yes, I'll watch it. Over.
And so they got fined $60,000 by the DEP, which is chump change. It means nothing to Sunoco, nothing to Energy Transfer Partners. So there is sort of, you know, regulation in place, but it's so ineffective that it does not keep these companies in check. You know, putting fines of five, six figures doesn't do anything. And, you know, imposing fines after the environment is already damaged doesn't really do any good for the environment. The Pennsylvania DEP is underfunded, understaffed, but that's not an excuse for issuing permits and then not having the capacity to regulate those projects, to oversee those projects. But that's what's happening in Pennsylvania right now. Like, the DEP admits, we don't have the staff to properly permit, but here we are handing out permits like candy and not sending our people out on the ground to make sure that environmental laws are followed. Not listening to the public when they report things. Problems with the industry, environmental violations, health and safety violations. Those things get reported all over Pennsylvania. And nothing seems to ever be done about it. Like, with the fracking industry in Pennsylvania. So they've been, you know, terrorizing people for more than a decade, polluting water, killing people with pollution, with contamination, with stress. And there were 9,400 complaints related to fracking made to the DEP that were just shoved into a box, put in a closet, and ignored. They're still unanswered. There's still people desperate for clean water that aren't getting any help getting it. The industry is just, you know, not taking responsibility for their accidents. The state, the DEP, is not forcing them to. So people are just left to fend for themselves and try to pick up the pieces and try to, you know, carry on their lives and try to survive with contaminated water. So now, with this pipeline boom, they haven't even dealt with what's come before, and they're allowing all these pipelines to come through and further destroy the environment and the watersheds and the air quality, you know, when it comes to compressor stations and things like that. The DEP is not out here with their clipboard taking notes. They're not watching for spills. They're not watching for, you know, violations of the Clean Water Act or the Clean Streams Act. You know, we're just left out here to fend for ourselves and try to, like, not only, you know, resist this, but at the same time, like, train ourselves to look out for environmental violations and, like, try to somehow enforce that ourselves with no resources and no authority and, you know, but yeah, so in Pennsylvania, it's kind of just happening like that. Supposedly the Mariner East 2 pipeline is regulated by the state, but the state has no capacity and no political will to actually do that. But
it doesn't change the fact that the Mariner East 2 is an interstate pipeline and therefore should have federal oversight, but the FERC is not regulating this pipeline. They do plan to regulate other pipelines in Pennsylvania, such as the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline, which is planned to go north to south through Pennsylvania and carry natural gas. But Mariner East and this whole NGL pipeline just seems, you know, somehow to not fit into any of that regulatory framework. And I couldn't tell you why exactly it's not being federally regulated. I don't think that Sunoco would have any trouble getting permitted by FERC for this project, so I don't know why they weren't, you know, required to go through that process, but they weren't.
Have there been, that you're aware of, like, any, like, violations or accidents, like, in the process of constructing Mariner East 2?
Yeah, well, to backtrack a little bit, they have the existing Mariner East 1 pipeline, which I was explaining was retrofitted in the recent past to ship the same product, NGLs, from Western PA to Marcus Hook near Philadelphia. It went into operation last year. It has had 3 reported spills in that time period. So there's that. And one of them clearly shows that the sort of emergency protocols that are in place failed, because the leak was not detected by the company. It was detected by a resident on the ground who saw that the ground around the pipe was turning black. So Sunoco's computers didn't tell them that there was a leak, or maybe they did and they didn't feel like it was important enough to deal with. Maybe they thought it was too small to expend the resources to deal with it, that maybe they wouldn't get caught if they just ignored it. So there we have, you know, a pipeline in operation for less than a year with 3 leaks. Now with the construction of Mariner East 2, which is a much larger diameter pipeline, we're talking about 120-inch pipeline going in right now. Sunoco plans to tear the entire right-of-way through Pennsylvania up again next year and place a second pipe in, which would be a 16-inch pipe. Let's see, it was a few weeks ago in Chester County. They were drilling underneath, I believe it's called Chester Creek. It's in Brookhaven, Pennsylvania. They were doing horizontal directional drilling, and they had a leak of that drilling fluid, which they try to play off like, oh, it's just clay, it's just bentonite clay, it's nothing to worry about, but it's actually clay mixed with chemicals. And the amount of, you know, drilling fluid that they use in those operations and all that clay can be deadly to aquatic wildlife. It happened in Ohio shortly before that on the Rover pipeline, which is another ETP project. There was a massive spill of bentonite clay and chemical slurry.
Yeah, that got that pipeline shut down, right?
No.
Or like they had to stop work temporarily. Maybe I'm confusing it with something
else. I could explain in detail, what exactly happened with that. But according to the Ohio EPA director, that slurry does kill aquatic life. You know, I would trust his opinion on that particular matter.
Yeah.
And so what happened in Ohio with the Rover pipeline was there was a 5 million gallon leak of that bentonite clay and chemical slurry, and it did kill wildlife. It is a huge deal. And yet that pipeline isn't stopped.
because of something like that. The only thing that's put on hold for them was new HDD projects, any HDD horizontal directional drilling projects that they were currently working on, they were permitted to finish, but new ones are on hold. I think there's about 8 of them that, because of that spill, are put on hold, but the rest of the pipeline construction is allowed to continue. And so it's just kind of like they're putting a pause on certain parts of it, but in no way, shape, or form is that stopping Rover Pipeline from being completed. They have plenty of other areas where they can be trenching and laying pipe while they're waiting for the smoke to clear. Mm-hmm. So in a similar and slightly smaller way, what happened with Sunoco in Pennsylvania is that they had a leak of the clay and chemical slurry into Chester Creek. And they put up a bunch of sandbags around it to supposedly contain it, but there's photos showing the slurry just leaking out from those sandbags. And then we had a lot of rain in that time period. You know, we're in spring and it rains a lot, and the creek rose, and it rose up over all those sandbags and was just, you know, washing that slurry downstream. And so that happened in Pennsylvania, yet none of Sunoco's HDD projects are being put on hold because of that. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have a regulatory agency or the head of a regulatory agency like they do in Ohio who's willing to step up and say, hey, this is a major problem. This company is doing whatever they want, and they're killing wildlife, and, you know, it's my job to stand up to that. We're not as lucky here in Pennsylvania to have someone in one of those positions who's willing to take that stance.
So before, you mentioned how the Sunoco has been getting approval for the pipeline sort of like in each individual county that it passes through. And something I was reading in my research on my way here was how some counties, I'm not remembering which ones, but I think closer to the east end of the state, have maybe not rejected the pipeline outright, but like had safety concerns and sort of that they want like a, I don't know if it's a pump valve or some sort of like safety equipment attached to the pipeline in their county that could like protect them in the event of a leak. And that, like, basically Sunoco and like the state of Pennsylvania, it seems like on behalf of Sunoco, is arguing that because it's a state utility, it's in the state's interest for the pipeline to be like to operate, and that like the state overrules any like local county regulations that might be attempted. But you're saying that like the state,
there's a lot going on there. Let me try to do it piece by piece. Just to be clear, it's not permitted county by county. The pipeline is permitted by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection.
Okay.
Statewide. What's happening county by county is eminent domain decisions. Okay. That's where the county by county thing is coming in. It started, the first eminent domain case was lost in Cumberland County. There were cases lost in Washington County. We lost our case here in Huntingdon. So that's the county by county aspect.
Okay.
Beyond that, in southeastern PA, which is the most populated segment of Pennsylvania, the most populated region, there are a lot of residents who were not informed about the plans to put this pipeline through their community because they weren't, you know, directly along the right-of-way. They weren't asked for an easement, but they live, you know, right next to one, or 1,000 feet away from one, or their children go to school, a place like Glenwood Elementary, for example, where the pipeline would put, like, the installation of the pipeline would put that elementary school in a blast zone, mm-hmm. if there were to be a leak that was then ignited. So, yeah, an area like that where you're talking about 3,000 people or so per square mile, they call it a high consequence area. And people are scared and upset that, you know, their lives, their children's lives are being put at risk by Sunoco's desire to export fossil fuels for the plastics industry. So, you know, there's been a lot of parents coming out, health professionals, engineers who, you know, understand sort of like structural layout of the pipeline and things like that, who have been really breaking it down to like show like how dangerous this is and exactly why it's dangerous and what could happen in a scenario. And those concerns have been presented locally to, you know, school boards, townships, borough councils, and also on the state level, there was a panel of citizens from that area who went and made a case to the Senate Committee on Emergency Preparedness.
This is like in the U.S. Congress or the state Senate?
The state Senate in Harrisburg. And, you know, they really know what they're talking about. They're educated people who have, you know, done their research, people who have worked in disaster relief, worked for the FFA, worked for, you know, work in aerospace engineering. You know, they understand these concepts. And so they've done work to educate other people in their community about that who maybe don't have that specialized knowledge. And so people have come out and demanded that these townships or towns, you know, come up with safety plans, emergency preparedness plans, same with the school district. One of those school districts, I think it's Rose Tree Media School District, recently held a drill at one of the elementary schools for a pipeline leak scenario. And it was really surreal, you know, to like see these kids, you know, coming out and like doing this practice run for like, if there's a pipeline leak, like here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna like calmly walk out of the school and get on these buses and go to safety. But the problem with that emergency drill is that you can't bring in buses if there's a leak of natural gas liquids, because those engines could ignite the gas. Cell phones could ignite that gas. A water heater kicking on could ignite that gas. Like little everyday normal things could, you know, result in a massive explosion. And so it's really seems like a kind of duck and cover scenario that's going on. You know, giving a sort of false sense of hope to people and a false sense of safety, because there is nothing safe about an elementary school being next to a massive natural gas liquids pipeline. That can never be safe. Sunoco has the worst safety record of any pipeline company operating in the United States. Out of, you know, 1,500 or more operators, they are number one. And you can find that info through PHMSA, that they have, I think it's now more than 280 spills, leaks, incidents in the past decade. Like I said, they had 3 spills on, or leaks on Mariner East 1 in the past year. On a pipeline that hasn't even been in operation for a year. And that's only an 8-inch pipeline. We're talking about these massive pipelines going in, and so we're talking about the potential for a much larger explosion. So, Yeah. Down that way, in the more populated areas, there are, you know, hundreds of residents coming out and trying to get their townships, their towns, their school districts to force Sunoco to, you know, help them come up with an emergency plan. Or just the, you know, the emergency management for the area to come up with it. But there's really no good way to manage something like that. Like, we witnessed that last year with the Texas Eastern Pipeline explosion that happened in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, which is southwestern Pennsylvania. The fire company that responded, the emergency responders, were at the mercy of the pipeline company. They had to just sit back and wait for the line to be shut off and the fire to burn out, because they couldn't get anywhere near close enough to it to do anything about it. The fire chief had said that he had to stop his vehicle about a quarter mile away, and in his, you know, full firefighter gear, couldn't get out of the vehicle. It was too hot. That fireball incinerated a house that was about 500 feet from the pipeline. Man who was there nearly escaped with his life. He was burned on 75% of his body. He had amputations due to those injuries. You know, lifelong thing he's gonna have to deal with. He's a new dad now since that incident. His wife was pregnant at the time. Luckily, she wasn't home. But like, that's the kind of thing we're talking about that could potentially happen. And across the state, there's no plan on how to deal with something like that. There's no resources on how to deal with that. Out here, there's even less motivation for emergency preparedness plans, because rural areas in Pennsylvania are considered low consequence. Which means that if a pipeline explodes, maybe only a few people will be killed, as opposed to possibly hundreds of people being killed if it happened in a more populated area. And so that doesn't seem to matter to anyone except the people that live here and the people that, you know, understand those risks that support us. Rural Pennsylvania has been a sacrifice zone for a really long time to many different industries. And so what we're experiencing is just kind of a continuation of that. The fire company we have out here, I appreciate them so much. I am glad that they're ready to respond in the case of an emergency every day out here to come to our aid. We've had to make 911 calls in the past, and they've been there for us. But they can't respond to a pipeline explosion. They can't help us in that kind of circumstance. I wouldn't expect them to. You know, it's not safe for them to try to respond to an incident like that. And we're talking about a volunteer fire company who, you know, doesn't get enough funding for their operation and has to, you know, hold fundraisers to be able to stay in operation. You know, they rely on donations and bingo and cornhole tournaments and fish fries and things like that to just, you know, be able to do their regular day-to-day, like responding to car accidents, responding to house fires, things like that. There's no way they can respond to a giant natural gas liquids fireball burning out of control that can't be turned off by anybody but Sunoco and Energy Transfer Partners.
So before, you mentioned that Sunoco has, like, by all accounts, a pretty troubled history of, like, accidents and, like, health and safety violations, leaks, stuff like that. And Sunoco and Energy Transfer Partners recently announced their merger. Like, so they're like the same company now, mm-hmm. whereas before they were definitely like were involved with each other. But so, and Energy Transfer Partners is like most people would know them as the company that's building the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is almost finished, and or is finished, but I guess isn't operating quite yet. And so I guess it might be operating by the time we publish this. But so you've been dealing with Sunoco trying to come on your land for what, about 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years.
And so I guess I'd be curious your observations on how sort of the dynamic or the attention being paid to your situation, like sort of like well before the movement against DAPL took off, and sort of how you see what went down at Standing Rock and sort of the aftermath of that, like how, like has that affected your situation? Has it like changed? Have you noticed like more attention or more support, or does the company or law enforcement seem more nervous, or like how would you say things were before and then like now after DAPL coming into the spotlight?
Well, I wouldn't say that we were resisting before anybody at Standing Rock. I think that, I mean, in simple terms, like, we had a tree sit about the same time that the camp was getting started at Sacred Stone, but that struggle has been going on for so much longer, you know, probably 525 years mm-hmm. of resistance. So, I would say, I mean, we never had national media coverage until after the No DAPL movement, the resistance at Standing Rock. And you know, I think that fight really mobilized a lot of people and spread a lot of awareness, and you know, there was so much attention on it. It was on the news every day. I mean, if you're looking at the right type of news, but and then like just the media, the grassroots media that was put out, you know, every single day to really show what's going on, and people telling their own stories was really, really important to get that truth out and not have it twisted by, you know, CBS News or whoever else. And that kind of aspect has been, you know, really helpful because, you know, people are just more aware of kind of like what's going on and, you know, how brutal the pipeline companies and the police can be to people who resist, and how legitimate the fight against fossil fuel infrastructure is, especially when it's an indigenous-led resistance. And you know, so that's something that we're really aware of, that like our resistance here is kind of hypocritical in a lot of ways because we're not indigenous. This, you know, resistance, this fight for property rights is happening on stolen land. And I think that when we put that kind of message out, people understand that more now than they would have, you know, if we were saying that before people knew about Standing Rock. Like, they understand what that means more so, and so I don't know, it's a little hard to say like how Standing Rock has changed this. I mean, we're still a pretty small operation around here, still struggling to get media attention for the most part. But I think that when people do hear about us, that there is more of a context there, having been educated by people from Standing Rock, from the No Dabble Resistance. Like, we don't have to start with at square one with everybody. A lot of people, you know, have some sense of what's going on. I think that because of that fight, we're able to do more national networking. For instance, there's the Stop ETP movement that's getting off the ground right now, which is a collaboration of organizers across many different pipeline fights that are all under that ETP umbrella. They're all Energy Transfer Partners projects. We have Mariner East 2, Trans-Pecos, Sabal Trail, Bayou Bridge. You were saying before how, you know, DAPL's basically done, but it's my understanding that Bayou Bridge is actually a southern leg of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which has not even moved into the construction phase yet. So, you know, people from those fights are able to get connected with each other now, find each other through social media and just, like, you know, pipeline resistance networks. And so the main way I think our fight is changing is that we're able to access a broader network of people resisting fossil fuel infrastructure. And I think that is, you know, kind of the next era of these fights is, you know, they're getting organized, so we've got to get organized. They're, you know, working on the national or global level, so we're going to do that too. We're going to fight this all the way from the frack fields to the pipelines, the plastics industry, the pollution that's a result of that. You know, we can fight them at all those points. We can bring people together from all of those struggles and, you know, make them one struggle, I think.
So you mentioned how there's, like, a lot more networking between different pipeline fights, and with this new Stop ETP campaign, people are, like, specifically connecting, fighting different pipelines being built by Energy Transfer Partners. And so, like, we were chatting a little bit earlier about how it seems like Sunoco is basically interchangeable with Energy Transfer Partners at this point, but so Sunoco, ETP, whoever, has been working pretty directly with, like, local and state law enforcement to come onto your property, for instance. Like, they're working with the pipeline company to bring their crews on and cut trees or do whatever they're doing. And with, I think it's called the Lancaster Stand, it's, like, another camp in Pennsylvania against the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline. I was reading how, like, North Dakota officials had been contacted by, like, local officials in Lancaster, you know, like, asking for help on, like, how to, like, keep pipeline protests under control. And I guess I'm curious what your read is on, like, locally in your area, either, like, messaging that Sunoco is using or how, I mean, like, they haven't come onto your property very recently, but, like, how do you have any sense of either how they're preparing or how they're trying to are they like gaining support from locals? Like, what like methods or tactics do you see them using?
Yeah, we're aware that North Dakota
law enforcement is coming to Pennsylvania to educate the police force about what they deem the appropriate way to deal with pipeline protests. And that doesn't just apply to protests in Lancaster. It obviously applies to any use of civil disobedience or direct action to fight a pipeline. And, you know, even people who don't use direct action do get targeted, do get surveilled, do have tactics used against them to try and stop their resistance. So, trying to think of how to explain it. I think that the biggest tactic used against people is fear. Mm-hmm. Always has been, probably always will be. They threaten people's livelihoods. They, you know, make examples out of people like they tried to do with us last year with arrests. And that does freak some people out. You know, they're like, well, if I go to jail for 3 days, like, what's going to happen with my kid? You know, I've had people express to me personally that, like, they would get involved, but they're literally worried about their children being taken away from them if they wind up in jail. They don't know what they're going to be charged with, you know. So I'd say that's probably the biggest thing. I don't know what to expect here when the police actually show up. I would expect them to be more forceful than they were last year, because last year was just kind of a show of force, an intimidation tactic. It was done preemptively as far as pipeline construction is concerned, but right now they're actually trying to put the pipe in the ground and get the NGLs pumping. So I would say that the company is much more desperate now, so they will use greater force to get what they want, and that I expect the police, both local and state, to do their bidding. I couldn't tell you specifically like what kind of training they're getting. I know that the local police force, before they came here last year, did get some kind of training on direct action tactics. They were talking about things that I know that they really had no idea what they were talking about, but they were like using words related to direct action. And
what kind of, could you give some examples?
I don't really want to get into it, but yeah, that they clearly had some kind of training, because, you know, this type of thing has never been seen in Huntington County before. There's no way that, like, local police, the Huntington County sheriffs, knew anything about tree sitting or blockades or anything, but they were talking about it in a way that showed that they did receive some type of training before they came here last year. Mm-hmm. What else is happening in Pennsylvania right now is there is currently a bill proposed by a senator whose name is Scott Martin. It's a bill that's titled something about like protecting critical infrastructure. I forget the name of the bill and the number right now, but the gist of it is they want to up penalties for protests on infrastructure sites. They don't want them to be misdemeanors anymore. They don't want trespassing to be considered a misdemeanor. They want to up it to a felony. Certain offenses would be a first-degree felony. Others would be a second-degree felony. For the second-degree felonies, they want to impose a minimum fine of $5,000. And for the first-degree felony offenses, they want to impose a minimum fine of $10,000. And this is a bill being discussed in the Pennsylvania Senate right now. So I feel like there is truly a conspiracy happening against the people of Pennsylvania right now by our own government, in favor of the fossil fuel and petrochemical industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know in Pennsylvania, I think it was quite a few years ago at this point, I want to say maybe 2012 or something, where like an anti-fracking activist went undercover at an Anadarko Petroleum conference or something, mm-hmm. and they were talking about, there was a presenter who had done psyops, like psychological operations mm-hmm. for the U.S. Army, yeah. like in the Middle East, and now works for Anadarko, and saying, like, we're dealing with an insurgency, you have to use counterinsurgency tactics against people who are, like, opposing your company's pipelines, and
right.
that's something I take a lot of personal interest in. Both in reporting and sort of in my spare time. And so part of, like, other than, like, actually using violence and force, like, the main component of counterinsurgency is, like, managing people's perceptions. And, it, like, a lot of it overlaps with, like, PR. Mm-hmm. And so have you seen, has Sunoco tried to do any sort of, like, local outreach or, like, tried to curry favor? Or,
yeah.
like, I know other landowners in the area have, like, signed easements and, like, received checks from Sunoco.
Mm-hmm.
Have they, like, how have you seen them trying to, like give themselves a sunny image
well,
in your area?
Yeah, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on PR. And that's always something that we're having to fight an uphill battle against. We don't have those kind of resources to spread lies. Not that we would spread lies, we would spread the truth, but you know, they take out ads in local papers about how many jobs they're providing and don't bother to disclose that when they say 30,000 jobs, they actually mean 30,000 job years, which is a different measurement, and means less actual jobs provided. They just go really hard on basically the jobs thing and try to pretend like they're boosting local economies. They always say that these pipelines have no impact on people or the environment, which we can pretty easily disagree with photos, videos, testimonials, of people telling the real truth. Recently, I want to say maybe a month ago, if that, Sunoco made it a point to have a non-publicized meeting with the Huntingdon County Commissioners, where, you know, it was just basically the same thing. It was just a PR stunt, but it was directed at the Huntingdon County Commissioners specifically. I'm sure that we are not the only county who has experienced that. There was evidence found in another county through a FOIA request that Sunoco had paid off the county conservation district with a $50,000 grant. I cannot disclose what county that is, but
okay.
that happened. So, yeah, I mean, they spend all this money to tell people how great they are. If they were so great, they wouldn't have to spend all that money. You know what I mean? Like, they would just do what they do, and people would love them for what they do, but that's not how it is. They do use a lot of PR. And then I couldn't tell you exactly, like, how they enact PSYOPs, how the industry enacts that, but clearly it's happening. You know, if Anadarko's using that tactic, why not Sunoco? You know, and the fact that they even think they have to go to those lengths against, you know, Pennsylvania citizens is pretty out of control. I mean, we're not the enemy to be fought against, but that's what we get treated like. We get slammed like we're anti-progress, anti-development, anti-modern life, anti-everything. But really what we're doing is for our communities, for our lives, for the environment. We're defending what we love. We don't want to fight. Nobody wants these fights. You know, this is a horrible position to be in. It's expensive. It's terrible to experience this pipeline infrastructure build out and infrastructure build out in general, but you know, they bring these fights to us. You know, they literally come knocking on your door. They literally come in your backyard or in your state forest or wherever it is. And yet we're treated like we're the ones attacking someone when all we're trying to do is defend ourselves, defend our families, stand up for the environment, protect the future. And, you know, I've had people say the most ludicrous things to me because they're hearing these PR campaigns and they're believing them. And, you know, I have people trolling me on Facebook saying, well, you need to just shut up until you aren't using gasoline in your car and you aren't, like, having home heating or this or that. And it's just, like, so missing the point because, you know, like, was explaining, like, nothing about these new pipelines is about domestic consumption. It's not about putting gas in your car to go to work. It's not about using it for your home heating. But people have these misconceptions because of all the advertising put out there by the companies. And, you know, people turn against people in their own communities because of it. Because they want to believe this apparent authority that's coming from the corporations. Like, you know, authority doesn't mean legitimacy anymore. It just means that you have power and money, and that's what gives you authority. Mm-hmm. And people are manipulated by that. They turn against their own neighbors sometimes. And that is, you know, the reality of what you have to deal with. In addition to that, like on the state level and soon to be the federal level, we have, I'm blanking out on his name right now, but one of the public utilities commissioners of Pennsylvania came out with a statement calling people working against pipelines jihadists, implying that we are terrorists, and he is now nominated for the FERC, and there are confirmation hearings coming up on May 25th in D.C. for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and that's going to be a very bad day if he is, you know, put in that federal position. It's bad enough to have him in a state position if that's his attitude, that, you know, farmers and teachers and parents trying to defend themselves and their families are terrorists to him. It doesn't bode very well. And it's really awful to be treated like that and to see people treated like that, who are just trying to mind their own damn business. You know, like, that's usually what we do in rural Pennsylvania. We mind our own damn business. And they won't let us do that. They won't let us live in peace. So,
yeah, you mentioned earlier how there's, like, some sort of statewide, like, so-called, like, anti-terrorism mm-hmm. task force that is, like, sort of, like, based on surveillance or trying to prevent, like, actions against the fossil fuel industry. Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, there's this public utilities commissioner in Pennsylvania you mentioned who's called people who protest pipelines jihadists, who might be now, like, a federal position. And we were also talking a little bit earlier, you know, like, Sunoco has merged with Energy Transfer Partners, who built the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Use terror to do it.
Yeah, that pipeline was built, you know, with, like, brute force as, like, its entry mechanism. So, in terms of like where we are now, I know there's probably like certain details you might not want to discuss, and that's fine. But so like we're sitting right now, where we're sitting is on your property, not on the easement. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is my family's property here.
Okay, but so like a few yards across the stream from where we're sitting is like there's all these felled trees, and this is the easement that is already under eminent domain for the Mariner East 2 pipeline, right?
Yes.
And so there's like a few active tree sits here, and then it's like a pretty short walk to the road, and right on the other side of the road is where like the right of way is already torn up. There's pipes sitting on the ground. Like last night we saw them put up floodlights. So I guess, without going into anything you don't want to go into, what do you see happening when they do decide they want to like finish their work here? How do you see that playing out?
I expect them to come with brute force. I mean, that's how they've done it in the past. That's what we saw at Standing Rock. That's, you know, the way that they do it. If they can't trick you, they bully you. If they can't bully you, then they attack you. So that is, that's what I expect. I don't know in detail, you know, what they're planning. It's, you know, I'm not necessarily afraid of it because there's not a whole lot I can do about it. You know, we're not going to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing is wrong, and somebody has to stand up to them. So, you know, we're doing everything we can to just be peaceful, remain peaceful, but put our foot down at the same time and stand up to them. And they want to build this pipeline, and we've seen when Energy Transfer Partners wants to build a pipeline, you know, they're willing to physically hurt people to get them out of the way. And you know, we've seen how the police are complicit with that. So, I don't know. At this point, I'm expecting to go to jail, potentially for an extended period of time. Been trying to prepare for that. You know, all I can say is that sometimes you just have to do what's right. You have to try and protect yourself from harm, and we're just trying to do everything we can to do that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess with the like almost guaranteed certainty of like Sunoco Energy Transfer Partners like completing their project on your land against your consent, like probably some degree of like police violence involved in allowing that to happen. Because I know that you and other people here seem to, it's like you have no illusions about where this will probably go. So why do you think it's important, or what do you see being like the lasting value of like choosing to be here and stand in the way, like even though you know that that's coming?
We've got no choice, because what they're doing with these projects is leading us towards an end game, you know, with the climate, with, you know, access to clean water and clean air. So we're in big trouble already. If we don't put a stop to the fossil fuel industry, we are going to lose anyway. So why not fight and at least, you know, try to set things up for the future, for future generations? If we don't do that, there is no hope there. And I think a lot of that was expressed in Standing Rock too. You know, it's not really much of a choice as far as I see it, you know, to let them do it. We're
gonna hurt either way.
So, I mean, people who aren't resisting this pipeline actively are gonna suffer from it also, you know. So it's like, well, you could suffer and let them do it, or suffer and put up a fight. So we just chose the latter is all. Don't fight fascists. Wait. What's the word? What's the phrase? It's like, oh my God. You don't fight fascists because you're going to win. You fight fascists because they're fascists. That's what it is.
Nice.
So. Maybe we'll win. I never know. It's not good odds, but I don't think it's completely out of the question. But it's also not really about winning. It's just, this is part of a constant struggle of, you know, humanity versus destruction. It's like the battle, I know, that has been, or the war that has been going on for ages. And, you know, this is just part of that ongoing struggle. There was a woman who told me once that thinking about things in terms of winning and losing is the wrong way to look at it, because there is no winning and losing. There's pretty much just the struggle. And I mean, if you look at history, it's there. We're not the first to put up a fight, and we won't be the last.